I remember when I was young, and the older generation, the old people like me, like I am now, back then would say, you know, that they really put thought into stuff back in their day. And then they would say, now, these days, they don't put near as much thought into it as they used to put in. And now I think, I heard them saying that when I was 5, 6, 7 years old. And now here I am, 67 years old. And I'm thinking the exact same thing that they thought back then, because Gene Roddenberry put a lot of thought into that. And I don't know, there's only a few stations, TV stations that are programs that I watch. There's not that many of them that are that interesting. Some of them are nature. Some of them are like Our Living Planet or something like that, because the dogs like to watch that. I'll sit there with dogs watching one of those, and a lion will come up there, and they'll stand up, and they'll raise up in their posture and straighten their posture up and start growling at the lion. So we have a good time watching Animal Planet and stuff like that. But if you think about back then when we were, I don't know, pendulum goes back and forth, I guess. It gets more, they had to work harder to get better ratings back then, so they put a lot more into it. Then when I was a kid, the same thing happened, right, with the previous generation, and then going forward, same thing, you know, it just continues. And I guess it gets to a point to where the pendulum swings back the other way. I don't know. I think it's kind of interesting, though, that, like you said, Gene Roddenberry put so much of his life into that, and you try to compare that to what you see today, and you don't get the same feeling, or at least I don't. KK4JBQ, W4DJW, the Blue Ridge Two-Meter Net.
Yes, that's true. Now, you can talk to 10 different people, and they'll each and every one have a different idea about those television programs and about what was entertaining within the episodes, and you'll find some people like myself who can quote the dialogue and tell you everything about them because I've seen every episode of the major. They went way off the deep end within the last 5 years, maybe 6 or 7 years. But there was a lot of good entertainment as well as thoughtful mind-bending, you might say, in science fiction. And I don't mind science fiction because I have a good imagination. I can imagine that the conditions that precipitated the episode that made the episode possible. That was the magic of Star Trek and other things like that. They successfully made worlds where you could talk about other things and imagine the John Q. Public, you know how we used to say that? John Q. Public walking through and taking part in conversations on board the ship, on the bridge, for instance. You watch it long enough and you know what's coming up and you know what the reaction is going to be. But there's going to be something that makes it a little bit different and it takes it in a whole new direction. It was fascinating. And all the while, it was saying something about the basic human proclivity. You know, what are we going to do given a certain set of circumstances? Well, that's going to vary. But it's in those variations that make it all so fascinating to watch. And it makes me want to see them all again, you know, truly, honestly. I'll never lose my curiosity. And I'll never have enough space in my head to hold every episode and be able to reflect upon it. Fortunately, there are reruns. That's what reruns do for us. One of the ones that I think most folks didn't care for, it was 7 or 8 seasons long. Not many, as Star Trek goes, the flashback series called Enterprise. It was before the Federation, and so a lot of things had to be established, and they could establish the reason why it was, you know, one of them, I'll tell you, if you've never seen Enterprise, they explained how Red Alert came to be. It came into being. The engineer and another one of the crew members had an ongoing thing for like four episodes. And when they finally came right down to it, the reason for Red Alert and so on and so forth. KK4JPQ.
Okay, well, now you got me wondering, what was the reason for Red Alert? What was the meaning behind that?
It's worthwhile to dip a toe into that. When they initially went out into space, they knew it was going to be something they'd never seen before, and they'd meet other life forms, perhaps. But what they didn't imagine is that there would be all kinds of prejudging by other races, you know? And this is what Roddenberry was so good at, you know? You can take people from other planets light years away and get into disputes and talk about the interaction of humans and those creatures and say something about the human nature, about human beings at the same time. So you'd have people who would meet you in space, and because they were not very fond of people generally, especially if they didn't look like, if those people they met didn't look like they did, didn't speak like they did, didn't do or eat the same things. You know what I'm talking about? You know, prejudice. He was so good at presenting prejudice on a plate so we could recognize it and talk about it without getting heated and you know, and formulate lifelong opinions about things. Anyway, so they'd run into people. Now, this the first Enterprise, the namesake of the series, of course, but this was the first Enterprise, a Class 5, that is five times the speed of light, was the top end for that ship. And they were just pouring everything into it when they got to Warp 5. When they got out there, they found all sorts of people who would shoot first and ask questions later. Now, when you meet up with somebody and you're just, you know, you're just on the trail like everybody else, and the first time you're aware of them, they're heading at you and closing distance fast. And their weapons are up and their shields are up. They're ready to go into battle, and you're not. As a matter of fact, they had a lot of talk to get the ship ready to endure a battle. So the engineer and a few others were talking, and they decided that we need to line up something that with one word or one phrase. And they entertained several, and that was kind of funny. We could do one word, the captain can yell it, or anybody else on the bridge. Everybody knew what they would do, what switch they had to throw, what button they had to push to make the ship ready to go into battle. And it really worked. Yelling Red Alert, you had about 3 seconds and you could endure a full blast of anyone else's guns. Now that was impressive. And it saved a lot of angst. And it lengthened the battles, of course, which kind of exciting. Did I fill in that enough? KK4JPQ.
Absolutely. That was really, really good. explanation of how they came about that. I really enjoyed hearing that up to the, you know, the depth, the reason that they did that, and human nature and any other alien's nature. Right. It's in the animal world. That's an animal instinct. I noticed with my puppies when they were little tiny things, anybody and everybody, they'd always love to go up to them, and we'd take them to the park and Greer, and there'd be little kids, there'd be adults. They wouldn't care. They just wiggle like little wiggle worms and just kiss them and love them all over them. And the other people love them to pieces. But now as they're getting older, now they're starting to get a little bit suspicious of the guy that's walking around the cul-de-sac, right, and start barking at him. Or the next-door neighbor when they pull in or they open their garage door and they step out. And so now the hair on their back of their neck, they're in the 7 months old now, so they're changing. And what changed them from that? What made them more protective? That's an instinct. And I think that's an instinct, humans in a lot of ways have been able to overcome, and in a lot of other ways have been fallen victim to not being able to overcome. So, yeah, I really enjoyed that. Let me check one more time. What time is it? It's a quarter after. Let me check one more time, see if we've got any other stragglers that would like to check in, or second shift or third shift that would like to check into the Blue Ridge 2-meter net. Call W4DJW.
So, in Kilo, Quebec 4, Hotel Lima, Zulu, Benson, and Marshall.
Negatron Lock recognize KQ4HLZ, Benson, and Marshall, North Carolina. Sounding good, Benson. Appreciate you taking the time to be here. Any other stations all the way through the alphabet? Well, Larry, I don't think you can top that one. You nailed that last one. KK4JVQ, W4DJW in the Blue Ridge 2-meter net.
Another episode that's classic to illustrate the same proclivities that all humans have, all of the humans I live in have. And I almost had the title of it, but it's in the original series, the first Star Trek. They came upon this crashed ship. They had landed on a planet or they'd beamed down. People who don't understand Star Trek, or seen as much as you or I have, would not notice my mistake, but I thought I'd call attention to it anyway, because the Enterprise was built in space, just outside the atmosphere of our planet. They had space docks where they built the ships, and then they launched from there. They were never intended to land. I think the first ship that ever landed was Voyager, which was like the third iteration of Star Trek. That ship did land. But anyway, they beamed down a dematerializing, rematerializing process on the surface of the planet. They did so because their sensors had shown that there was a crashed ship there. Well, they found aboard that ship one passenger. It was a single passenger ship, a little thing. And they brought him back to the ship, and they got him back into good health. Come to find out that he was He was chasing another of his own kind. And when they started to, I'll try to make this short, when they started to get into the nuts and bolts of why he had been, and he's been doing this for years, why he'd been on the chase to run this person down. Well, it's because of his, he was just so different. And get this, the difference between the fellow who was chasing and the fellow that was running from him was that the fellow that was chasing was white on the right side, all the way down his body, and black on the left. So right down the middle of his forehead, right through his chin, and going to, you know, one hand was white and one hand was black. So he was white on the right and black on the left. And he was chasing the other guy because he was black on the right and white on the left. Just the opposite. And this was the great difference between these two. And it caused them to be, for the one to be chasing the other for many years, as it turned out. So the absurdity of that, it's kind of like looking at our own proclivity to take a difference in skin color and assign something that should never be assigned for that reason. Assigned a manner of intelligence, a manner of whatever, you know. It takes a lot to get to know a human being. Anybody who's taken the trouble will agree that it takes a lot to get to know a human being. You cannot tell a great deal just by looking at them. That's what Dr. King meant. KK4JBQ.
I do remember that episode. I was thinking it was a different episode that you were describing until you got deeper into it, and then all of a sudden I switched over to that one because there was another one that was kind of similar to that. There was some kind of a reception or a meeting they were having, and with among a whole bunch of different planet people, not people, beings from a lot of different planets, and some of them ate fish, and some of them ate trees, or something like that. I mean, planets or plants or life or something like that, and they had to keep them separated because they constantly wanted to fight with each other. And eventually, they got together and they did fight with each other. And this is all on the Enterprise. This one might have been the one that had Picard. I think Picard was the captain of that one. And I think the one you were talking about is a lot sooner than Picard. But I do remember that. It took me a while to figure out how are they different? Because my brain didn't pick up on one side of their body being one color and the other being the other color and the other one being opposite of that. My brain didn't just pick that out all by itself. They just looked the same to me. But then when later on, I think one of them was explaining, I think they kept questioning, why are you doing it? Why are you doing it? And he said, look at, it's obvious. And to the crew, it wasn't obvious. He had explained it to them too. So, yeah. And that was, Gene saying how ridiculous those prejudices are that are innate, that are native to existence, right? That's what allowed us to become top of the food chain, is by being cautious and by looking out for stuff like that. And then you get to a point to where you have to say, now, wait a minute, that was required way back then to migrate up to the top of the food chain, but that's no longer a requirement. And you have to, and that's what Gene Roddenberry was so good at making you think. Forcing you to think and figure that out on your own. He didn't come out and say that to you. Those words were never spoken inside anybody's head except for each individual member of the audience that was thinking about that, the people that were just mesmerized by the shows.
Yeah, you make some points there that, I haven't seen that episode in a very long time. Right on through the original series and everyone after that. Now, the reason that it could be so is that while Roddenberry lived, he wrote a Star Trek Bible. And it regulated so well how the story would unfold. And it wouldn't name what the genesis might be, or what the various tools used by the various characters might be, what troubles they would run into, what friction there might be, who would find allies and who would find enemies, or anything like that. But it nailed down so many things that made it consistent there would not be inconsistencies that someone who was listening closely and watching closely would see. Remember, they were doing this originally. The original series accomplished by, well, I think Paramount was initially approached, and they had a pilot, but after the pilot, they dropped it. They weren't going to go forward with it. And then Desilu Studios from Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. Desilu Studios picked up Star Trek and made it the thing that it is. And they eventually sold it to Paramount, who took it, and all the other spinoffs were accomplished by Paramount. Anyway, that Bible was so well put together that it laid the framework for everything to be, well, it's like singing in tune. If you have a chorus of people or a chorus of different series of Star Treks, if they all sing on the same note, and all the way through the song, every episode, well, that just makes it more more likely that you can, for a moment, believe that you're watching something that's somewhere a reality. KK4JDQ.
And I guess that's what allowed them to continue to make more episodes later after his passing. Because they were able to consult back, you know, to see what would he have done in this situation. How much information would he spoon feed you, or how much information would he make you figure out on your own? Right? You can't give them too much, you can't give them too little. You got to keep them interested, but you can't tell them the answer. They have to come up with the answer themselves. Really, really powerful. And that's probably the only reason it kept going long after he passed.
Another was that I think four of the directors for each episode, there were four that were as enamored with Star Trek as Roddenberry was. And then two major characters, such as Geordi LaForge, the fellow with the visor. He directed like six episodes. And I think there might have been four or five members of the cast, having done it for years, you know. They were very, very aware, and you know, things occurred to them. They would write a script, and they'd pass it all around, and everybody helped out, and you'd have one of the leading characters direct when they shot a new episode, which they had written. How about that? Yeah, so Roddenberry had a good formula, you might say. KK4JPQ.
Well, we're an hour and 27 minutes into it. I think we're down to the worm in the bottle. And the chips and the salsa are gone. What else you got for us, Larry? This has been an interesting night. KK4JBQ, W4DJW, and the Blue Ridge 2-meter net.
You might guess that I could go all night. And I would have fun doing it. Neither of us would think much of it after, I suppose. And I would perhaps lose my voice a little more. So I'll call it. But it's been a fun time. Anytime I can repose something that I like as much as I like that. But I've noticed something about myself. I'll ask you one question and maybe that'll help. Did you see The Goodbye Girl?
That name sounds familiar, but... been a long. I'd need my memory recalled on that. That name sounds familiar, though.
If I knew the names, it'd be a lot better. But the director was married to the lead female. And Richard, oh goodness, can't remember his last name. The lead male, and it was pretty much boy-girl type of thing. But the gist of it is that it was a movie that was that hung on dialogue. Star Trek is the same way. If it wasn't good dialogue, and if you couldn't hang on because new possibilities and new ways of thinking about stuff, it was coming all the time. You had to be prepared for that. You had to be wanting that in actuality. But in Goodbye Girl, which was before Star Trek was ever on television, it was great dialogue. And as I say, the director was the wife of the lead, the female lead, and, oh, Richard Dreyfuss, not Richard Dreyfuss, maybe you know, who was the lead character in Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
You were correct. That was Richard Dreyfuss. The Goodbye Girl is a 1977 American romantic comedy drama film directed by Herbert Ross, written by Neil Simon, and starring Richard Dreyfuss. Marsha Mason was in there, too. Does that answer the question?
And what I was trying to say, it's better if you don't have to go through all that, but Marsha Mason was the wife of the director, Neil Simon, and Richard Dreyfuss, who would later do the movie Close Encounters, was the male lead in the film. Now, there was a daughter, a very precocious, I would say, 7-year-old, who had a lot of good lines and was an important, pivotal character. It's a very worthwhile movie. But you will just be frozen to the screen because of the way the thing is written, the dialogue between the characters. It was fast. You had to be perky, you know. You couldn't, be distracted by anything because so much was going on there. The story was being told in real time. And it was such a good story. It was all in a New York apartment, for crying out loud. There wasn't a great deal. You got one shot out of a window to a telephone booth on the corner. A couple of shots like that. Everything else was inside that little apartment. It was all dialogue. It was just great. I'll probably never watch another movie quite so focused on dialogue. If you read the script to that movie, you would read dialogue, but from the point of view of the screenwriter or the author of a play, for instance. And I've done some plays also, community theater, and I learned a lot about how important it is to have the right thing to say, for crying out loud. And if you're an actor and you got a few lines, it's important to get the right, to be right on the dot. You let another 2 seconds pass, and what you're going to say doesn't mean as much. It doesn't apply in the same way. Our language is fascinating like that. And so the faster you can think of where you're going, or, keep in one hand what the other person is saying and have your own dialogue, your own comments in your right hand, it's going to be a lot more fun. And I'll say this too, in winding this up, it's a lot better if you don't have to talk simplex or duplex. Yes, it's that's the way of it. It's a lot better if you don't have to talk duplex, because I'm sure there were places in my soliloquies that you'd like to butt in and add a penny or two, you know? But you can't do that with this particular setup. That takes face-to-face, right? Dave, it's been a lot of fun, and you've been very patient with me. And I don't know if we've got a stringer or two out there that is still listening, but if you are, you don't have to identify yourself, but it's been fun to have you along with us tonight. This is KK4JBQ. I'll turn it back to you, Dave. 7-3.
Well, Larry, I surely do appreciate you hanging around for the Rag Chew portion of the net. You always make it very interesting, and I really do want you to know that I appreciate that. I'm probably not by myself. I remember 20 years ago when I started listening to this net, and a little over 20, about 21 years ago now, when I started listening to this net, I was amazed that people got together, that this whole world was going on behind the scenes, and I didn't know anything about it, right? I knew my dad was part of Blue Ridge Amateur Radio Society, and I knew that they used to go out to the woods and set up antennas and all that kind of stuff. And I knew I used to hear him talking in the other room when I was busy doing something. But I never really paid that much attention to it until I got into my 40s and became a ham radio operator. And in the beginning, I would just listen. I wouldn't talk. And I know I was very appreciative of people that were doing that and that had been doing that for 40 years. Right? I was very appreciative of that. So, yes, keep it up. Appreciate you being there. Appreciate the stories that you bring in. The same kind of feelings that I had that you were going through when we were young and watching Star Trek, right? And never will forget that. And I do remember the Goodbye Girl now that you're talking about. I never saw the movie, or I never read the book, or never. That was in 77, and in 77 I had graduated high school in 76, and I went to I had that one summer off, and then I went into full-time employment with Michelin. In the latter part of 76, and in 77, was when this came out, is when I was full-blown into learning what I was supposed to be learning at Michelin, and I had a buddy that we both had enough money at that time for him to get into drag racing at Ware Shoals. So I took my 59 Chevrolet pickup, and I towed him down to Ware Shoals every weekend to do drag racing and building engines when we weren't working, engines and transmissions. So I wasn't watching much TV at all back at that time. But anyway, Larry, do appreciate you bringing up good old memories, and look forward to us doing it again the very next time we can. Any other stations all the way through the alphabet that would like to check into the Blue Ridge 2-meter net, called W4DKW.
W4DKW. Kilo Quebec 4 Lima Bravo Alpha. Just want to see if I can still make it in from Black Mountain.
The control like to recognize Kilo Quebec 4 Lima Bravo Alpha. That's Travis from Black Mountain, North Carolina. Yes, Travis, you are making it in. It's not full scale. It's close, and it's not full quieting. There's a little bit of white noise, but you're 100% readable. So do appreciate you taking the time to check in with us this evening. It is working. Any other stations all the way through the alphabet that would like to check into the Blue Ridge 2-meter net, called W4DJW. Okay, have I missed anyone for check-ins, or have I missed any rag chew called W4DJW? All right, be sure and stop back by tomorrow night where KO4HKX Patrick will be calling the Blue Ridge 2-meter net at 9 p.m., same frequency, same time. I'm sure he appreciates you checking in with him on his net, and I'm sure you will enjoy his net as well. Please stand by for my net report. This is W4DJW now securing the Blue Ridge 2-meter net. Well, thanks for checking in. We'll now return the repeater back to normal amateur use. 73 and good night.